And the court will proceed to the second case, the United States versus White.
For the counsel.
Ms. Leatherwood.
May it please the court. I appear this morning on behalf of the appellant, Johnny R. White. The main issue before this court is whether the district court committed reversible error when it denied Mr. White's request for an alibi jury instruction, when it granted a continuance, thereby violating Mr. White's right to a speedy trial, and when it admitted into evidence a purported Ameritech telephone record, although the government failed to authenticate the document and failed to disclose it to the defense prior to trial. As the court erred on all of these grounds, Mr. White's conviction should be reversed. Also, the court erred when it enhanced Mr. White's sentence based on factual determinations not supported by jury findings or by the evidence in the record. Therefore, in any case, Mr. White's sentence should be vacated. First, the district court committed reversible error when it denied Mr. White's request for an alibi jury instruction that would have specifically informed the jury that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant's presence at the time and place of the offense.
I mean, they didn't have a reasonable doubt instruction?
They had a general reasonable doubt instruction.
If I recall the evidence, it was an alibi that covered a different time than the crime.
I'm sorry, excuse me?
It's my understanding that the proffered evidence was, the evidence that was in the record was for a different time than the crime.
The alibi evidence?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. White presented two alibi witnesses, Nyla Gentry and Mr. Sawyer,
right,
who testified as to Mr. White's whereabouts,
right,
at the time of the crime.
Right. Not at the time of the crime. After the crime.
Well, the bank robbery began at 10:45 a.m.
Mm.
But there was testimony as to the whereabouts of the robber prior to 10:45 a.m. and then after 10:45 a.m.
I thought it was 11:30 was the first time anybody suggested there was an alibi.
Mr. Sawyer provided uncontradicted testimony that he called Mr. White at Miss Gentry's home, which was located 14 miles from the bank, sometime between 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. the morning of the crime. So if that testimony were true, Mr. White could not have committed...
Do the telephone records bear that out?
The telephone records were not introduced into evidence. So he did present two witnesses, and Nyla Gentry also testified. She corroborated Mr. Sawyer's testimony that she had answered a telephone call from Mr. Sawyer the morning of January 9th. And she also testified that Mr. White was at home with her at least between 11:30 and 12. If the bank robbery began at 10:45, Mr. Sawyer could not have been at home with Miss Gentry 14 miles from the crime at 11:30.
It's not really an alibi, though, as Judge Bauer says. An alibi means when this, in the 2-3 minutes that this robbery took, 10:45 mm-hmm. in the morning, he was in a different place. And I admit you have some evidence that if the jury were to believe it, could find reasonable doubt here, but it's not an alibi. An alibi is at 10:45, at that time, precise time, I was in a certain place. And
well, Your Honor,
didn't offer that here.
He did present testimony that he was elsewhere from 11:30 to 12, and the crime. Well, again, while the crime began at 10:45, there was substantial evidence of events that occurred after 10:45.
Means that you got the wrong person, and he didn't do it. But doesn't mean it's an alibi.
But it is an alibi in that he presented testimony that he was elsewhere at the time that the crime occurred from both witnesses.
The government. the government did not serve a request for a notice of alibi here, which they could have. I don't know why they didn't, but they didn't. And that would say, you have to, if you're going to rely on an alibi, you have to tell us where you were at 10:45 on that day and what witnesses you have to support that. And what would you have said? You couldn't. You would not have been able to respond to that and say, at 10:45, I was in a, I was in jail. I was working at Miller Brewery or whatever.
Well, again, while the robber entered the bank at 10:45, the events occurred prior to 10:45 and after 10:45. And he did present testimony from Mr. Sawyer that he was at home between 10 and 11 a.m. And as White did present these two witnesses, the court erred when it decided that since it believed that Mr. White's alibi contained holes, it would withhold the proper jury instruction. It's the jury's job to weigh the evidence, and the court must not withhold instructions that would help the jury in its duty. The theory of the
That evidence was before the jury, and it was argued to the jury that he couldn't have been there because he was someplace else.
Yes, the evidence was presented to the jury, but
the jury was told if they have reasonable doubt as to whether he committed the crime, they should bring in a not guilty.
But the general instructions regarding the government's burden of proof was inadequate to inform the jury as to the burden of proof as regards to alibi, that the government has to prove that Mr. White was at the time and place.
Well, isn't it self-evident that if the government has to prove he committed the crime, they'd have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt he was there when he did it?
While it seems self-evident, the jury has to be instructed as to that point because it's a nuanced area of the law.
Not much of a nuance.
But the jury might instead have believed if Mr. White failed to prove his alibi, then that's evidence of guilt. Convicted on that basis.
Actually, the reason you want to give an alibi one is a false alibi gives an indication that you're guilty. It's a, the guilty flee when none pursue is the predicate for it. But, I mean, the judge is given a wide accord to decide whether or not, in his opinion, the evidence supported an alibi at all, let alone the requirement for a right. But apart from all that, it seems to me that the instructions covered your subject exactly, considering you had the right to argue before the jury that if he wasn't there, he couldn't have committed the crime, and if he didn't commit the crime, if they believed that, they would have to find a reasonable doubt on the crime.
The instructions didn't cover that topic, and that the danger remained that the attempted alibi would be misunderstood, and the jury would use that as evidence of guilt.
A phantom problem, but I mean, go ahead. I understand you're doing a very good job, by the way, with the gossip or threat, but keep up the good work.
The theory of defense instruction, of course, was given.
Right, correct.
And let's assume just for argument that a case can be made that the instruction for the alibi should have been given based on the predicates you've laid out. In this case, with the theory of the instruction, theory of the defense, excuse me, given a relatively short trial, why doesn't that capture and address the nuanced concerns you have, together with, obviously, the other instructions?
Because only a very specific, narrowly tailored instruction would adequately inform the jury as to the burden of proof as
to
alibi.
He had only one theory, right, which is the alibi. I mean, let's just use alibi not let's use it in its most general term. I wasn't there. And then the theory of the defense instruction speak to that and give all the latitude necessary for argument.
Yet the instruction didn't adequately guard against this very real danger that the jury would misunderstand the alibi evidence and believe that the evidence was weak, the defendant didn't prove his alibi, and therefore that's evidence of his guilt. And that's a different standard than convicting because the government proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
What does the alibi instruction that you would have thought should have been given in this case say? What would it say?
It would say that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant's presence at the time and place of the offense. And this court held in
isn't that what the, going to Judge Bauer's question, isn't that what the jury is told? They can only convict if they believe beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed the elements of armed bank robbery.
Yet the jury wasn't informed that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt his presence at the time and place. While it might seem obvious, it is a subtle difference, and it's an important difference in that the jury could convict based on an erroneous standard, based on the fact that Mr. White failed to prove his alibi as opposed to the fact that the government proved its case. It's an important distinction.
Well, could you argue that with the submission of the alibi instruction in this case, it might actually burden the defendant a little bit more? To your point about his having to establish, you want the jury to focus in on whether he's established he's elsewhere.
It wouldn't have burdened the defendant at all. It would have informed the jury. Again, the defendant's theory of defense is that he was elsewhere, yet the burden of proof never shifts to the defendant. It remains on the government at all times that basically the government has to prove that the alibi was not true. That instruction wasn't given, it prejudiced Mr. White, and therefore his conviction should be reversed. Also, Mr. White's conviction should be reversed because the court violated his rights to a speedy trial. The court violated Mr.
Didn't White. I understand it? He agreed to that?
I'm sorry.
Did he agree to the continuance?
No, Mr. White did not agree.
He objected to it.
On July 20th, Mr. White objected to the continuance on the basis that the trial did not implicate a novel issue of law. It was a straightforward robbery case. Witnesses were ready to go to trial, and they were ready to proceed with trial on July 26th. Hmm. So the defendant had the objection on record. Yet the court overruled the objection and ordered a continuance until time under the Speedy Trial Act. Under any calculation, without even counting those days that the court improperly excluded, more than 70 days expired between the time of Mr. White's indictment and the time of his trial.
Weren't there a lot of judges that were taking a careful approach at this time, and rather than try the case without knowing how this Booker Blakely thing was going to shake out, and didn't know what issues would be, what sentencing issues, what were traditionally sentencing issues, should now be submitted to the jury? Why would that be an unreasonable position for a judge to take, as Judge Stadmiller did here?
Unfortunately, I can't answer the question as to what other judges have taken. I just know in this case.
Yeah, you're not responsible for every other case.
I'm not really sure of the different approaches. It's just that in this case, those issues weren't implicated. And in order for the exception to apply, the novel area of law has to impact trial preparations in this case. And on September 17th, the government even informed the court that it was ready to proceed.
One of your arguments is a sentencing argument that certain things were done without a jury making determinations. And if the judge wanted...
Well, it was that the sentence were based on facts that weren't found by a jury and also weren't supported in the record. So it truly didn't implicate... trial preparations weren't implicated in any way by Booker. And also the government even conceded in its brief that Booker didn't necessitate the continuance and the filing of the superseding indictment. The court informed the parties that...
You're eating into your rebuttal time.
Okay. Then...
I just want one question to make sure you get it. How did the amount of money arrived at in this case?
Well, the court imposed an upward enhancement on the sentence based on the fact that over $10,000 was involved in the robbery, and there is no evidence in the record at all as to that amount. The only amount that is mentioned in the record at all is the amount of $8,826, which the authorities recovered after the incident. So there is just there was no support in the record whatsoever substantiating that finding.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leatherwood. Ms. Marino Taxman?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Corrine Marino Taxman, and I was trial counsel in this case. Let me first answer one of your questions with regard to the evidence in the record with the amount of loss. If the court looks at the pre-sentence report on page 5, which is in the defendant's appendix, page 88, it specifically says $11,590.
Who said?
The pre-sentence report put in that amount.
But does the record prior to that in the trial show how much money?
The trial shows two things. The trial shows that the police recovered the $8,000-some
right.
amount, and also that there was money that was flowing out.
But it doesn't show any amount other than that $8,000-plus.
The transcript does not, but since the amount of loss is not something that has to be put in the record of the trial, it's something that can be found at sentencing, that it's a sentencing matter. The pre-sentence provided that amount. The defense was given an opportunity to object and did not object.
What does the indictment charge?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the indictment originally did not have the $10,000 amount. When Blakely first came out, then we superseded and
added. So it's
added
a second indictment.
It said the second indictment said over $10,000.
And you went to trial on the second indictment.
When we went to trial on the second indictment, we dismissed the sentencing enhancements, because at that point, this trial found itself.
We dismissed what?
The sentencing enhancements. This trial found itself between Blakely.
A rock and a hard place. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So and I take issue with the point that I somehow conceded that Blakely and Booker did not affect this case. On the contrary, at the end, when we went through that whole path of what should we do.
And the judge knew more than you did. He could foresee the Booker problem.
Yes. Yeah. And if we had gone to trial on the indictment with the sentencing enhancements at the first trial date, that could have actually been to the defendant's prejudice, because several of the enhancements would have been put to the jury for the jury to decide. Did the defendant flee and cause injury or potential risk of injury to the other parties?
Well, he got banged for the enhancement without it being in the indictment, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
So it meant is you didn't have to prove it.
Well, it also meant that the focus at trial was on the crime as opposed to.
Well, that's an interesting concept, but the fact of the matter is, under the rules, I think you're supposed to charge before you can enhance.
I do not believe the indictment requires the over $10,000 amount. And so the fact.
Well, I don't think the trial does, but the enhancement does, doesn't it?
No, it does not.
Oh.
No, that is a sentencing enhancement, and that's something that is.
We can reach in. Well, you don't have to charge it, we say, but we can enhance it. What's the purpose of putting it in the indictment if you don't have to?
Well, the position is you don't have to put over the $10,000.
Well, why would you put it in at all? You put it in the first time. Why'd you put it in?
The first time I didn't put it in, Your Honor. I put it in.
You've confused me then. When did you put in the enhancement provision?
When Blakely came out. And we
so
were trying.
So the enhancement was in the second one.
That's correct.
And that's the one you went to trial on.
No, then we dismissed all the enhancements because at that time Booker had come out and said that these were not issues to be decided by the jury. So there was a special page called Sentencing Enhancements where we put all the sentencing guideline issues
mm-hmm.
in it. Then as Booker came out.
So your theory is that Booker fixed it so you didn't have to allege X and prove. That would enhance the sentence.
Do not have to prove the $10,000. And at the time of sentencing, when the pre-sentence provided the amount of $11,590, the defendant did not object. The record is very clear that he accepted that amount. He had the opportunity.
That's a better ground than to say that that you don't have to. You just reach in and decide. Let the probation officer decide what the amount was.
I agree with the
court.
Obviously, what I meant to say in a more artful way is that it was in the pre-sentence. There was a sentencing hearing. No objection to that amount. And at that point, that means the defendant agreed. As a matter of fact, Judge Stanmore specifically asked if he took any issue to the factual basis in the pre-sentence, and there was no issue taken with that amount. I would just like to address a little bit about the alibi instruction. I think this was not an alibi case. It was really a case where the defendant chose not to testify, which is completely his right, and then tried to piece together a circumstantial puzzle or blanket where tried to show that he could not have been there.
Did he say that he was at the time at 10:45? Did he represent he was somewhere else?
He never represented any specific place that he was at 10:45. Also, this 14-mile distance, I don't know how many of 14 miles comes from the investigator, Ms. Rice, testifying that she took a bus route And that's how she got 14 miles, including a transfer. Basically, it sounds like she went all over the city of Milwaukee. I don't think there's two points in the city of Milwaukee that are 14 miles apart. So that number is really...
They're constantly telling me I live in a, you know, a cow town, so
that's right.
Be careful.
It's small, but no cows.
Okay.
No cows. So I think that that number is not something the court should rely on at all.
Well, did the government challenge that number?
The government challenged it by having the different... specifically challenge it? Yes. In the cross-examination of Ms. Rice, we specifically went to how she got to that number and showed
that... circuitous in some way?
Yes, two buses, transfer, not the same day, right. Not the same time of year, that she never compared the routes of the day that, of the crime. And in addition, there was no testimony that the defendant went home.
You know, I'd asked the your opposing counsel about why... or made an observation that no request for a notice of alibi was ever served by the government. I thought that was a fairly routine thing to do in a time, place specific charge like this.
It's not routine for me to do. I knew the defendant was not going to testify, and so I just didn't. You know, in hindsight, which is always perfect, maybe I should have done it. But it's not something I would routinely
see,
do.
As I look at it, though, if you had done it, given the evidence they offered, the defense could have said, we don't intend to offer an alibi, and could still have put the evidence in that they put in, because it wasn't technically an alibi.
That is correct. And then, again, that would show that they would not be entitled to the alibi instruction. They just never... the other point that I wanted to make also is that the testimony of the witnesses does not cover... the time of the crime, and also contradicted itself throughout the testimony, so that the reference to the page in which the phone call is claimed to have been made by Mr. Sawyer is just the testimony is he made a phone call, not that he spoke to Mr. White. The only testimony of when Mr. White was reached was between 11:30 and 12 by Ms. Gentry. So if the court has any further questions?
Apparently not.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'll make sure I don't hit any cows on the way home.
Ms. Leatherwood.
Just to momentarily discuss the issue of the $10,000, this was plain error in that there wasn't any testimony regarding that amount in the trial whatsoever.
Well, didn't the $11,000 come from the bank? In the pre-sentence report,
I have no idea where that amount came from. And again, there wasn't any testimony. There was only testimony regarding the amount of $8,000.
Well, $8,000 was found,
right.
Or something like that.
It was found after the
gun and everything that was found.
After the robbery,
it was ditched by the passenger, who
correct.
The government claims is your client.
Correct.
But,
and that's the only testimony as far as the amount of money. There was testimony that some amount of money was left on
the... That's the amount of money that was found.
Correct.
But, that doesn't mean it's the amount that was taken.
And it doesn't mean that it wasn't. There isn't testimony regarding an amount of over $10,000. There's no other testimony whatsoever regarding another amount.
The pre-sentence report says it was $11,000, which I assume came from the bank. The bank knows how much money was taken. Was there any objection to that?
There wasn't an objection to that during the pre-sentencing hearing, but it was plain error in that there wasn't any testimony.
Well,
there's just no evidence substantiating
that. Why does there have to be testimony? Beating a dead horse here, I guess. So I'll pass.
The other issue is that there is evidence in the record that the distance between the house and the bank is 14 miles. Basically, that was the distance between point A and point B directly, not through transfers. The alibi evidence was not contradictory. Mr. Sawyer testified that he spoke to Mr. White when he was at Ms. Gentry's home between 10 and 11, and Ms. Gentry corroborated that testimony when she stated that prior to 11:30, she answered the phone, talked to Mr. Sawyer, and handed the phone to Mr. White. Therefore, he did present evidence that he was elsewhere at the commission of the crime and was entitled to his alibi instruction.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. Ms. Leatherwood, in addition to the thanks I just extended, I want to give an additional thanks in connection with your accepting this appointment, and thank your firm for participating in this, and we would welcome you to do it again. I don't know whether your firm would want to lose you again, but we would do it, and Ms. Marino-Taxman, you're welcome to come back to the big city again, too.